Hello and welcome to Escape into Storytelling. I'm Jennifer Bradley, and this is a chapter from my self-published novel, Virago. New episodes drop each Monday, and all chapters will be available at the end of the book. As always, there is no charge. Virago is intended for a mature audience, and today's episode contains language and discussions of graphic violence. If you missed last week's episode, it is available from the same podcast source. Now please, sit back and escape into storytelling with me in today's episode. Chapter 13, Bright Shapes Against the Darkness. For a week, Neville and Carver worked. The first day, they hauled pork carcasses to cold storage under a large, expensive house in Westmont. The biggest carcass was 80 pounds, the smallest 50, and they each carried at least 4 dozen. Down the cellar stairs with the slick skin pieces of meat, heave the carcass up onto a waiting hook, then back up the stairs for another. 10 hours of work earned them each half a ducat. They were too exhausted to make the walk back to East Coast, so they slept under a shop's crawl space. After 6 days, they'd harvested fall vegetables from backyard gardens, naturally all of them big and unwieldy like pumpkins, or requiring them to shuffle about on their haunches to cut various gourds free of vines, hauled ordure from a butcher shop, painted a wagon, and unloaded a carpenter's supply cart. On the 7th day, they nearly died. A stable needed extra hands holding down a spirited stallion. The horse's owner refused to let the grooms lay the horse down, insisting it was safer for the beast if he remained standing. Neville and Carver were handed ropes and instructed to help hold the horse with 2 other men, but still the stallion, straining and kicking, had pulled them nearly off their feet. He lashed with his forelegs, kicked with his back, snapped with his teeth, and swung his hindquarters around in attempts to sweep them off their feet. After 2 hours of manhandling this living hurricane, they were each handed a half ducat. Battered and worn to the bone, they found themselves in one of Glendale's small city-owned parks. They lay under a walnut tree, their hands cramped into claws, backs and legs aching from everything else they had done for the week.
Well, that was certainly something. My arms feel like I'm still pulling.
Mine, too.
The sky stretched blue and empty in all directions. Branches rattled in the wind.
I forgot how hard working day after day is.
It's a shame you can't find work sitting on your ass all day. Pay me a few coins and I'll sit like no man ever sat before. You may depend on it.
Neville pulled up some brittle gray grass and offered it to the wind.
2 ducats. 7 days for work for 2 ducats.
At least it's 2 ducats each, and that's 2 more than when we started a week ago. 5 more weeks of this and we'll be laughing. Oh!
That'll almost pay off Adelaide. I can't keep living at the Bell. Annabelle's agreed to let me stay on if I fix things around the house and help clean up, but I've fixed everything there is to be fixed.
That's her own fault, fixing things though they say fixed. Do a crap job and just keep fixing it over and over, and charge the same each time.
Neville tore up a few more needles of grass and watched them drift away.
I've all but been hiding from her the last few days.
Aye, she's a good woman. I'd have thrown you out weeks ago.
5 more weeks. Gods, I'll never gamble again.
Neville flexed his leg, producing a loud pop and a splinter of white-hot pain just below his kneecap.
Been hurting all week. I think I did something to it that first day on the stairs.
You know.
Carver moaned. He had tried to reach across his chest into his jacket pocket to fetch his pipe, but his arms were still too tender. He managed to get it out of his pocket, then began a long ginger search for his flint and tinder.
Blast, I'll be dead at a week in this rate. Anyway, I was going to say, we might find work of a more generous and less punishing sort elsewhere.
Elsewhere?
Leave the city?
I mean work that's not strictly above the table. Carver gave up on the pipe and let it be. Lying on his chest, it looked like a premature grave offering. Neville frowned at the sky. I've got better things to do. Oh? Got a busy day lined up getting kicked to death by a mad stallion who don't want his balls cut off? Don't let me slow you down. Well, it's honest. Is it honest of them to pay shit for jobs that could kill someone? And anyway, this work would be no different from what we've been doing all week, except we'll be better paid. I don't know what kind of work you're talking about, but with this work, we won't end up in the stocks. You know damn well that anyone can wind up in the stocks, or worse than the stocks, now the Manhunter's back. Who? Carver sat up, his back popping like a bundle of twigs, and looked around. He dropped his voice and went on. Sakes alive, man, I thought you grew up here. The Duchess's spy master. He's back, and now he's in charge of the watch. And believe you me, innocence swung just as much as guilty when he was down here before. Now he's been serving the king, it'll be doubly so. Probably learned all kinds of evil tricks down south. The Duchess wouldn't allow that. Carver rolled his eyes. The Duchess would allow birds to nest in her hair if she didn't have 100 people looking after her. She was well past caring how the city's run. It's all the nephew these days, and a bunch of lords and ladies in silks and velvets. They don't care about us down here. He made as if to lie back down, moaned, and sat up, slapping his head on his knee. It's going to be every man for himself soon, and I'd rather be running at the head of the mob than the back for once. I can't keep this up. If nothing else, my body isn't up to it. 10 years ago, I could have done anything that was asked of me and been fresh as anything the next day. Now I need a day or two until I can even walk. All right. Adelaide walked home from work, yawning and rubbing her eyes. The days were growing shorter, and her thin cloak was not quite enough to keep out the wind. By the time she reached the Ann and Bell, twilight had come on, and the bright lights in the kitchen windows were a welcoming sight. The slamming of pots and pans and the grim mutterings of Annabelle inside were also, in their way, strangely comforting. Once inside the house, she announced herself and received no reply. She smelled fire, cooking herbs, and fresh ground pepper. Goes off and does what she likes. Oh, never mind about the sprouts. I'll bring them later. My foot. Think it'll last forever? Think I'll have her back once he's had his fun? With another mouth to feed? Adelaide went into the kitchen to find Annabelle chopping a carrot as though it had personally wronged her. The stew pot hung in the hearth, water boiling in the black cast iron. Leave her be. Treat yourself to dinner out and leave Annabelle to stew. Instead, she asked if she could help. Do these. A bowl of potatoes was thrust at her. She scrubbed them and was halfway done peeling before Annabelle was able to speak. I don't know. I just don't know. It's not like I beat her or anything. Her chores aren't that bad. When I was her age, I was mucking stalls and taking care of horses. Big, dumb, filthy beasts. You'd think a girl with as much freedom and pocket money as she has would be thankful. Adelaide made a sound of agreement before asking, Where is she? Annabelle waved her knife toward the door. Out. Know how I know? Because Maggie come by earlier looking for her. The same Maggie that Miriam told me she'd be out with all day today. The same Maggie she was supposedly out with all day yesterday, but who hadn't seen her since last week. The chopped carrots were dumped into the pot. Done yet? Almost, Adelaide responded and sped up her peeling. The herbs fell under Annabelle's fury. Scents of rosemary and thyme filled the kitchen as she hacked in silence. Thyme leaves, already small, were reduced to a sticky green paste. Adelaide finished the potatoes and dropped them in the pot. Do you want me to go get her? Annabelle shook her head. Hell with it. If she wants to run around at all hours, do who knows what with who knows who, when she could be in a safe house with hot food, then let her. I'm not chasing her anymore. All right. I'm just going out to the wash house to freshen up then. On the way out, Adelaide took her thin cloak. Yellow shapes hung in the night. Glowing rectangles, squares, and circles showed people moving to and fro, letting out smells of food, pipe smoke, ale, and wine. The people inside talked, sang, played instruments, did needlepoint, drank and loved and fought in the little lighted spaces they made against the darkness. Adelaide sighed and looked at the street ahead.
The Blue Ribbon. Maggie said she's at the Blue Ribbon with her boyfriend. Annabelle and Miriam will fight when she comes back, but at least she'll be home safe. And I need to know she's all right. I'll leave her be if I think she's safe. But I wonder why she felt she had to keep him secret.
The Blue Ribbon stood on Scythe Street, the southernmost street in East Coast, and the same street where she and Carver met with Remiel. The line of buildings backed on sea cliffs, their lights bright against the vast black void beyond. The ribbon blazed with life. Raucous voices sang a merry song and stamped time on the floor while a fiddle played. The chimney belched glowing smoke, and various layers of smells hung in the air, from fresh fruit and fragrant pipe smoke all the way down to unwashed bodies and stale beer.
Miriam might be mad or embarrassed. Maybe I should wait and see what's what before I do anything.
Adelaide walked past the building until she reached shadows thrown by a pile of barrels and doubled back down alongside it. She ran along the building to a window, pulled a crate underneath, and climbed up, peeping between the shutter and its frame. There were about 20 people in the pub, making merry and at various stages of inebriated. The fiddler sat on a barrel in the middle, an old man with a pointed nose and waves of dark gray hair. He fiddled and sang The Lost Lover in a rolling tenor.
Over the blue hills I looked for your face. I rode a steed of canvas and wood. I looked upon the cliff, your usual space, but only a shade waited where once you'd stood. I asked for you in the hillsides. I asked for you all round the town. I asked for you in sun and moonlight, but you spoke from neath the ground. None gave me the name who had done it. None saw or heard what was done. But you spoke to me from the darkness, and that was how justice was won. Oh, that was how justice was won.
Adelaide was almost too busy thinking how much she hated the song, one of those dreadful dirges about murdered women and the fine men who avenge them that are so popular with drunk people, when she spotted her friend. Miriam sat on the far side of the pub in a booth. She held a tankard but was giggling too much to sip from it. Next to her sat a handsome blonde boy, his head thrown back at a cocksure angle as he looked down at her.
I don't recognize him. He looks older than her.
The fiddler's song ended. He unseated the instrument from neath his chin and pulled a rag from his pocket to dab at his forehead.
Again,
the blonde boy called. He flipped a coin at the fiddler. Miriam laughed and set her tankard down so she could clap along with the song.
What's she playing at? She hates that song more than I do.
Twice more the fiddler lowered his instrument, and twice more Miriam's friend flung a coin at him.
He's thrown a ducat each time. That fiddler just made 2 weeks of wages for 3 songs. Is Miriam's friend a lordling, son of a city master? Maybe the son of a wealthy merchant.
The cock of his head and the way he summoned barmaids with a languid wave indicated he was familiar with service, but not with hard work or courtesy. Finally, Miriam rose to leave. Adelaide slipped down off the crate and crept to the corner of the building, staying just out of sight. Music blared as the two came out onto the porch, then the door shut behind them.
After dark, Simon? Mama will be mad.
So, you can stay here with me tonight.
He sounds almost bored, as if he doesn't care what she does.
Oh, I want to, but I shouldn't. Adelaide peeked around the corner. Simon stood with one hand on the porch rail, his head tilted at an arrogant angle.
Then stay. My room's ready. I told you, I keep a place here. Nobody'll bother us.
You were serious?
Stay or go.
He gave a toss of silky blonde hair. Then he pinched Miriam's chin in his fingers and gave her a long, slow kiss. Miriam's eyes were wide and startled, and then slipped closed. She sagged against him. As Simon's arms wrapped around Miriam, a growl cut through the pub music. Adelaide put a hand over her mouth and ducked back into the shadows.
Stupid, stupid.
Must have been a dog.
I really want to stay. Maybe tomorrow night?
Tomorrow I'm busy.
Oh, well, will you walk me home?
I'll see you around. Maybe.
Footsteps, then the creak of a door. Once more the pub noise blared and lowered as Simon went back inside. Adelaide heard a little sound, like someone swallowing a sob, then the creak of the porch stairs. Miriam stepped into sight, her head bowed, her thin shawl pulled around her hunched shoulders. Adelaide moved through the shadows. She ran down a street parallel to the one Miriam trudged down. She cut through an alley, turned the corner, then ran to her weeping friend.
I hate that I'm doing this, but I'd hate myself more if I walked away, and I don't want her to know what I heard. Oh, there you are! Maggie told me where you were!
Miriam stopped and made a futile effort to wipe her eyes.
I was just... What's wrong?
Nothing, just...
Miriam looked up, stricken.
Does Mama know? Did Maggie tell her?
Adelaide winced.
It was an accident. She said you were at the Blue Ribbon with your boyfriend.
Oh!
There, there. Let's get you home.
Adelaide put her arms around her friend and stretched her cloak around the two of them. Winston's backyard was normal, as yards in East Coast went. Enclosed by a low stone wall on three sides, it had a lean-to for the firewood pile and privy, a small stone-lined pit for outdoor cooking, laundry lines, dying herb garden, and a few tiny trees. A decrepit shed was home to an old broken crockery, yard tools, and junk. There was a wooden gate on both sides of the house, but one was broken and Winston had nailed it shut rather than fix it. The backyard was peaceful in the evenings, with the pounding surf sometimes audible if the wind was right, and there were even fireflies in the summer.
We don't sit out here often enough. It's so nice in the autumn.
He held Gabby on his knee, bouncing her, and all three inborns sat on the plain wooden table and benches he'd built. The wood was rough and gave out splinters with the generosity of a doting grandparent handing out sweets, so Gabby always sat on his lap or an old blanket.
Wake up, fool. Melora's talking.
Winston shook his head and looked at his wife.
What?
I said stop bouncing her. She just threw up. Give her here.
I told you she looked a little seasick.
Oh!
Gabby did indeed have some of their recent dinner dribbling down the front of her shift. She tried to grin at him, but her eyes looked a bit askew.
What's wrong, Wynn? You've been miles away all night.
Melora took the toddler and began dabbing at her face. Her brown eyes moved between Gabby's face and Winston's, full of worry.
Tell her everything's fine. Tell her you were just thinking. You're all right now, right as rain.
Instead, he shook his head.
It's better if you don't know. Safer. Well, that was the wrong thing to say, he thought, as upset crawled across her face, making her dark eyes flash.
What kind of...
A knock at the front door interrupted her.
I'll get it.
We're not done talking. Candles on the kitchen table flickered as he moved past. Without any more thought than if he'd picked up his cloak for cold weather, he lifted his short sword from its place under the stairs. As he approached the door, he loosened the blade in the scabbard with his thumb.
Careful. Keep it out of sight and at the ready.
There was no one outside.
Stupid, they've gone around.
He whirled and crossed the house in a few massive strides, bursting out the back door. Melora looked up, startled. Gabby hiccuped and looked at him with round eyes.
Was there... Did you see...
The firewood pile was still secure under its little lean-to. Melora's herb garden still struggled for life. Their cart was still up to its axles in a drift of dead leaves. Melora spotted the sheathed sword.
What? When? What's wrong?
He crossed to the cart and looked into the back, even though it was so slatted and broken down that he could see the back garden wall clear through the sides. He investigated the shed, looking in through holes in the roof. Melora's face tightened.
Is it that bad?
If I say yes, she'll go to the farm.
Should I go to the farm?
Yeah, I don't want her to go. It always upsets Gabby's stomach, and I hate when she does. But on the other hand, if the house isn't safe...
He chewed his lip.
Go ahead to bed. I'll wash up.
As he spoke, he signed, "Someone here." Melora turned toward the shadowy corner of the house, then nodded. Be careful. Ready whistle, she replied. She carried Gabby inside, shutting the door.
Her footsteps creaked on the stairs and then stopped.
There, by now she's got the whistle ready in case of trouble.
In the garden, there was no sound but for the sword hissing from its scabbard. The wind blew. A footstep fell. Winston's swing nearly hacked the walnut tree down. He swore and put his foot on the trunk to draw the blade out of the cut.
I'm coming out. I'm unarmed.
A shrouded figure appeared at the corner of the house. It moved across Melora's herb garden, trying not to tread on anything. In the dying light, he could just make out a hooded head and false beard.
Don't get too close. I stink like hell.
That's putting it lightly.
Winston raised a hand to his face. Over the desiccated basil and thyme, Gerald smelled as if he'd built a roaring fire of offal and put it out with human waste, all on the beach at low tide. Winston managed to yank his sword free. The blade left a deep white bite. Gerald indicated the white slash, impressed.
Good one.
Winston gaped. In Dockside, he had been too distracted to get a good look at his former Lord Commander. Now he realized there wasn't much difference between the old man and the walnut tree. Both were seasoned and slim. The dried mud was gone from Gerald's face, but it was lean, lined, and tired. Beneath the rags, his body looked like what it was, a frame for skin and organs to hang on.
Is there any more of that stew left?
Winston fetched a big bowl of leftover stew and a tankard of ale, pausing to tell Melora that all was well. Gerald sat on the bench downwind and fell to the stew immediately.
Is this a Gerald I never knew? Is this how he was when he was younger? He got a bit soft from all the desk work, but he always seemed happy enough. Now he seems like he's been chewed down to the bone.
Gerald finished eating and regarded him, rubbing his eyes to focus.
Sorry, I've been up for a few days. Nothing but a few catnaps here and there. Where have you been? I had Luthus camped out on your porch. You haven't done anything else, have you?
Winston shook his head.
Good, good. People don't need to know I'm away. Maybe you or Luthus could go in and light the hearth fire for an hour or two, so it looks like I'm at home.
Winston nodded, bemused.
Maybe dress up in your clothes, do a bit of gardening, some marketing, make a nice roast on Sundays?
Aye, that'd do. Luthus is more my size, and of course he'd have to hide all that hair and wear long sleeves. I haven't worn hats as much as I used to, but in the right light, from far away.
You're serious?
Well, if I'm gardening in my backyard, I can't be hiding in a crawlspace under Angry Ander's latest hideout, can I? Or in Sly Skinner's attic? Gerald tapped the side of his nose and pointed at Winston. Winston leaned forward and licked his lips.
Tell me. I'd tell you everything if I had time, but there's somewhere I have to be. I should have already set out for it, but I wanted to see you first.
What? What is it? I'll come with you.
Gerald shook his head.
That's why I'm not telling you. I'm going to watch, and that's all. No arrests, no sword fighting, no rushing into the fray to get myself killed first and ask questions later. You've got to remember you have people relying on you.
He nodded toward the house.
Them? The rest of this city?
But I can help, I can...
What's the best way to save a drowning man?
Ugh. Don't jump in yourself unless you absolutely have to. Throw him something. Find a way to reach him.
Why?
Because otherwise he'll drown you. He'll panic and pull you down with him.
It's a hard thing to do for us. Other people have no problem standing there with their hands in their pockets saying, "It's not my problem. He shouldn't have swum there in the first place." They can sleep at night, later on. The world's full of people like that, and that's fine. But not you and me. The faces in the night, remember them?
Winston thought of his father and Gert's face the day he told them Mother was leaving and wouldn't be back, and there'd be no more cutting words or stinging slaps. He thought of the first man he'd dragged out of a bar fight, his face twisted with indignation. And of course, he thought of the mother on the axe head, asking to be hanged last so her son wouldn't see, wouldn't be alone.
I always.
That's all you have to think about then. And now,
Here's a bit of what I've been up to the last few days, and then I have to be off. First of all, whoever did for those knots in dockside that were hung from the swordfish, it wasn't the Skinners. And unless the knots are crazier than anyone thinks, it wasn't them either. I was under the Skinners' back porch, in their privy, even under Sly's office once, and I never heard a whisper about it until after it happened. And they were all wondering what the hell happened too.
Maybe they were being careful.
Gerald shook his head. No, that sort of thing, it's not the sort of thing you brag on, but it gets talked about. Anyway, the point is none of the lower level Skins did it, or I would have heard. It's possible that Sly's found someone new to do the real butchery. I've been looking for a new face, somebody that the others are buying drinks and fetching food for. No luck so far. Gerald paused to sip his ale. Winston digested the information.
What about Bedloe? What's he doing down there?
Nothing useful. He thinks he's at war, and he's not all wrong. He goes out on patrols, mounted like you saw, and busts heads, but he's not going after the right ones. Half the reason the whores are inside now is because he's got his men chasing them off the streets. Upholding common decency, he calls it. But some of his men are shaking people down behind his back, especially the whores.
What?
Protection money. Or just demanding money because they can. But they're not going after the actual criminals. They'd get their heads kicked in and they know it. No, it's the regulars, the people who just live and work down there. That's why there weren't any hoppers on the street either. Winston blinked, running back over his memories of the day.
He's right, no children in the streets. It's been a long time since I heard that name. The little frogs people use as fish bait.
No messengers, no pickpockets or hawkers running around underfoot. No hoppers of any kind. Gods, it has to be really bad for that to happen.
You're right, the streets were clear.
Calm, I have to calm down. Think of your family, think of your friends and the city you're responsible for. You can't go rushing off with Gerald into the night.
But what's going on down there? Who's in charge? Why hasn't anyone said anything?
Lots of reasons. For one thing, Obi's retired. He had a firm hand on everything down there, but no longer. For another, there's no commander who knows Bedloe well enough to know he's up to something. As far as the ladies' table are concerned, he's a good man who's worked hard to get where he is. And when, as much as you don't like it, it's partly true. He bought those horses, and he bought the watch house some good armor and weapons, too.
A rich man's son who bought his way up...
Some things you can't buy, Wynne. If he really was a bastard, he'd be taking his cut, along with the rest of them. Instead, he's out getting in fights with drunks and smokehounds, missing the forest for the trees. You don't know him, you don't know what he's been through, or what his faces are. You can't hate him for making mistakes, Wynne.
Some of those mistakes are costing people their lives.
Winston forced himself under control, crossing his arms and looking away.
Are you done? When children can grow up in Dockside without learning how to cut throats or pick pockets before they walk, I'll be done.
Winston gave a curt nod. Look, I know it's hard to hear. It's hard to see, believe me. There are things going on down there that... It might look like I'm not eating, but I am. I just sick it up half the time.
Winston nodded, his own stomach in knots.
I'd better go. I waited around here too long as it is.
Gerald, what can I do? I have to help. I have to do something.
You're doing it. You're being the kind of watchman this city needs. Remember the faces. Do the right things for them. Serve them. Protect them. Watch over them. And when you have to, fight for them, just like you did in that basement.
The haggard figure gave him a weary smile. With a rustle of rags, he was gone. Winston sat on the bench. The sword's point was on the ground between his feet, and he rotated the handle in thought. After a while, he went inside the house. He was careful to replace his sword under the stairs. This concludes Chapter 13 of Virago. Stay tuned for the next episode, Chapter 14, Moonlit Forest Adventures.
If you want to read along, Virago will be available in abridged print or ebook format from Amazon later this year. If you enjoyed this work, please remember to like, share, and subscribe so you never miss an episode of Escape into Storytelling. Thank you for supporting independent and self-published authors like me. Until next time, be seeing you.